Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Over the weekend, former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden announced that he had been the leaker of top secret documents that revealed widespread internet and phone surveillance by the government. The news has many Americans up in arms, declaring an intrusion of privacy, but others are saying it's necessary to maintain national security. According to a recent survey from the Pew Research Center, 56% of Americans are okay with the NSA's terrorism-related surveillance activities. What do you think about the recent revelations concerning the NSA's surveillance procedures? Necessary to protect Americans from terrorists or an invasion of privacy? Joining us this hour is a guest who knows a great deal about the national security operation in this country, and it is huge. William Arkin is co-author of Top Secret America, a very important book that was released in 2011. The subtitle is The Rise of the New American Security State, and the book was based on a four-part 2010 series that he worked on with Dana Priest of The Washington Post. We spoke with Dana on September 21st of 2011, an interview which is worth hearing again. William has been working on the subject of national security for over 35 years. He's been a military advisor to many non-governmental human rights and environmental organizations. He spent the night in Sodom General Hospital in 1991, after being injured by an unexploded cluster bomb in Iraq. He picked through the rubble of Slobodan Milosevic's Belgrade villa and Mullah Omar's compound outside Kandahar in Afghanistan. He says that he is probably the only person alive who can say that he's written for The Nation magazine, Defense Daily, and the Marine Corps Gazette. He's been a columnist and reporter for The Washington Post and The Los Angeles Times. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, if you would like to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. William Arkin, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be on.
I so remember the interview we did with Dana Priest a few years ago on the book that the two of you wrote, Top Secret America, which is an incredible eye-opener. And I'd like for you to remind our audience of how large the whole surveillance security operations in this country are. We are spending a huge amount of money on this, aren't we?
Well, we are spending a huge amount of money, and the intelligence community itself, a $90 billion a year enterprise, constituting 1.4 million people with top secret clearances, a third of whom are private contractors working for private companies, has grown since 9/11 and continues to be healthy and vibrant, and in many ways is the centerpiece of what we call the war on terrorism, and is at the center, I think, of the future of the United States.
Mm. As she reminded us, and you did in the book, we have done all this because we missed the attack by 19 young men with box cutters. We, of course, subsequently missed the attack by two brothers setting off bombs at the Boston Marathon. In some hearings yesterday, some of those who are familiar with all we've done have said, although they won't tell us what it is, well, we really did, because of all of this surveillance, keep ourselves from 12 other terrorist attacks.
Well, I believe that, and I do see that there is some value in what is happening. I also think at the same time that there is an allure associated with the idea of making the entire planet transparent and, through doing so, protecting the country. And I think that we are at a turning point, perhaps, in our country where we have to decide whether or not the activities of the government to sort of create this perfect system and this transparent world are necessary and required by the gravity of the threats that exist to the United States. As we saw with the Boston Marathon bombers, all of this effort is not ever going to stop the last determined terrorist. And we've kind of learned that lesson again and again, whether it's with the underwear bomber or the Times Square bomber. And it seems to me that as a citizen, as well as an expert, I have to ask myself, you know, what the effort is achieving, and then I have to ask, what's the impact of all of this activity? And Snowden's revelations this week, the so-called whistleblower from Booz Allen Hamilton, is not so much a wake-up call. It's not even news that's necessarily something we didn't already know. But it is representative, I think, of political dissatisfaction with the war on terrorism. He was politically motivated in the same way that WikiLeaks people are politically motivated. And though people call him a traitor, as many people call him a hero, and that tells me that we're at a point now in American society where we can begin to discuss what the war on terrorism is and what we want it to be, rather than just to be continuing on this autopilot that we've been on since 9/11.
Don't you find it remarkable that so many years now, after September 11th, we really have not had that conversation? What kind of counterterrorism program we want to have? And we haven't had a public discussion of this, so we find out and we suspected these kinds of programs were happening. But some of the information you can't get to because it's classified information, so you can never find out what the truth is. And we don't seem to be able to say, what is it we need to put in place in order to counter terrorism? Why are we not having that far-reaching conversation, would you say, William?
Well, part of the answer is it's national security. So part of the answer is, you know, we're not talking about education policy or agriculture. We're talking about national security. And mm-hmm. So there are great secrets involved. And that's what we sort of have a little window into in this past week. But I think also part of the reason is that we're talking about a phantom enemy. You know, this is not a state versus state conflict. This is a conflict that is against a set of individuals, people, human beings that are not necessarily easily identifiable. They're not necessarily easily classified. They're not necessarily in an army structure or a cellular structure that even can be defeated. We've sort of set ourselves on a goal of counting, if you will, counting and finding an infinite number of potential enemies. And I believe, at least, that the process of doing it, the process of going through the effort of trying to create security for ourselves, is actually stimuli for the perpetuation of the enemy. Mm. So we sort of have two problems or conundrums that we have to face. One is that we don't do a very good job of figuring out how to tell our adversaries and those who would wish us harm what it is that is our purpose that does not threaten them. And second, we conduct our affairs in such a way, particularly in this secret world, unknown to the American public, mm-hmm. Where we are essentially building more terrorists and provoking more attacks. I don't mean to blame us, but I mean to say that there is an organic stimulus back and forth in which the very act of collecting all of this information and processing all of this information is an intrusive act that others see as threatening.
Can you give me an idea of all it is? First, we were hearing about Verizon. Now we hear about Facebook and Google and other organizations, and we don't know exactly what kinds of information have been collected. Do you have a handle on who's collecting what?
Well, one thing should be made clear. I think that there are two worlds here we're speaking of. There's the legal world of subpoenas and agreements, and you'll notice that this past week, Google and Facebook and Yahoo and others have all come out to say, we have no agreement with the NSA. There is no PRISM program. We've never heard of it.
Right.
But there is the secret world, and the secret world is that these are the holders of the information, the majority stakeholders, if you will. And when our government decides that it needs to have access to what it now calls big data, huge amounts of information to sift through, to look for dangers, it's not necessarily going through the legal door to do it. It's going through the back door. And there may be one person or 10 people within those gigantic companies that are privy to these operations. And that also at the same time allows the public company to say, we've never heard of PRISM.
Right. Right. The whole thing is kind of out of another world. Why do you think it is, and we'll go to phone calls in a moment, this Pew Research Center released a poll, and I've talked to people as well who said, listen, if it prevents a terrorist attack, it's fine with me. I'm okay with this. And almost half, if not more than half of Americans say that they feel fine with these surveillance activities. Why would
we
say that?
Unless you're a hermit living off the grid somewhere, you are just as much being surveilled and categorized, and your data is being collected by every company that you buy something from, every credit card transaction that you make, every car that you rent, every airline ticket that you buy. Our lives are now data that is collected by advertisers, by marketers, and by the government. So it's not as if we live in the kind of privacy environment that we might have lived in 10 or 20 years ago. And we as Americans, I guess, have to decide whether or not that's the world we want. But it is the world we have, and it's not perpetrated by the NSA or by bad actors in the government. The second point I would make is I think that people are hoping that indeed the government has the capacity to secure us. Mm-hmm. So if the tools are there, that there is a sense that that it's okay. But I think there's a different lesson from the Snowden affair. Okay? Here's a 29-year-old techie, an employee of a private company, a job. He's in a job, okay? Yeah. And he works in a system where he has a clearance and he's in a cleared space on a closed network where after 9/11, we were told by our government, you know, we'll share information, we'll secure information, we'll do a better job. And then came another attack, and they said, write us another check, and we'll make it even better. And mm-hmm. then another, and they said the same thing. And then WikiLeaks came, and they said, okay, we'll close the back doors, and we'll preserve our secrets, and we'll safeguard ourselves better. And now we have a case where he was able to take top-secret documents off of his closed network and transmit them electronically to a journalist. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, wait a minute here. The government and its host of contractor adjuncts is not omnipotent. They can't even keep their own house clean and their own house in order. And so, though I tend to say I give them permission to do all of this on my behalf, I'm also at the same time extremely skeptical, if not critical, of their ability to do it.
William Arkin is our guest this hour. He's an analyst, author, journalist. He's been working on national security issues for over 35 years. His career spans an assignment in Army intelligence in Cold War Berlin, 74 to 78, to best-selling author, the book that was a large bestseller in 2011. Actually, it was a best-selling nonfiction book, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. It was based on a four-part, very important 2010 series in the Washington Post. He worked on it with Dana Priest of the Washington Post. We welcome your phone calls. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. We have many of them and are anxious to hear from you about this whole issue of surveillance, widespread surveillance by the government, and the information that Edward Snowden gave us, and what's happened to him and where he is, and the information that he's given us subsequent to that initial information. He's now saying that we've been hacking China for quite some time. What do you think? Good in the name of stopping possible terrorist attacks, or a very large invasion of personal privacy? To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls. Let me give you other ways to reach us. Our lines are busy on this, which is a good thing. But you can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at @KDunnShow. Let's go to Tara in Zion, our first caller for you, William. Hi, Tara.
Hi there. You know, just listening, I was thinking about why Americans haven't had this big conversation and why they've been kind of complacent. And I wonder if part of it is that we've been isolated, you know, over here in our part of the world, and we don't have a history of a totalitarian government, but so we don't expect it. And I was remembering how I interviewed this woman from Argentina for a class project, and I asked her, the assignment was to ask her, what's the differences between your culture and this culture that you see? And her one of her number one differences was that she said, you know, people, no one here really talks about politics a lot, you take elections for granted, you take democracy and freedom for granted. But, you know, in Argentina, we talk about it all the time because we know what it's like to live under a military dictatorship and for people to be thrown in jail just for their political beliefs. And I really think that has a lot to do with it. I think we're kind of take things for granted.
William.
Well, just for a second, then I need to self-promote because I have a book coming out.
Yes. I know you do, but I don't know much about it.
Okay, so this book is called American Coup: How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. Mm. And it's on this very subject. And see, the funny thing is, I can't in good conscience call the United States a totalitarian state. I can't even call the NSA and the intelligence community evil, because what the American coup is to me is this kind of devil's bargain that we, the American people, have made with the government that says, we're going to check out of our national security. We're going to not be burdened by the effects of war making. There's no rationing. There's no controls on our lives. The only real connection most people have to the military activities of the United States is that a large portion of their federal tax dollars goes to pay for the troops. But what's happened instead is that we've had this uniquely American coup, a kind of desk-bound takeover of our day-to-day lives. And that's what this book is about. And I think that the caller is exactly right. It's we've kind of let this happen. I don't think that it's particularly post 9/11. It began in the Eisenhower administration with the advent of the possibility of nuclear annihilation. But I do think that it has become much more powerful and holds much greater sway over our day-to-day lives, even in a place like Wisconsin, where since 9/11, you've seen the creation of a Department of Homeland Security at the state level. You've seen the opening of fusion centers in which intelligence information is collected, in which police work together with the FBI and other intelligence agencies. So even in every state, we now have a national security apparatus, and that never really existed before, and it doesn't seem to be going away. And so this way of life, this way of martial life that I call it, is our way of life now, and it looks very different than what life might look like in a place like Argentina.
Yes. Thank you, Tara, very much for the call. Susan in Madison, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I strongly disagree with your guest. I feel that I have every freedom that I want or need, and I couldn't think of a better use of my tax dollars than to prevent terrorism. And I think it's a common sense approach that we have not had any attacks since 9/11. And
we had the Boston Marathon bombing, Susan. What about the Boston Marathon bombing?
Well, I mean, we can't prevent everything. I mean, but look at how safe we have been. How wonderfully safe we have been. Yes, there has been an incident here and there, but we cannot even fathom where we would be at if you took this away. I mean, it's just incredible that that you're proposing that. I just do not understand at all. Of course, we all know that we're being under surveillance and things, but that's the price you pay to be safe.
Okay, William. A lot of people share that.
I'm not necessarily disagreeing with your caller. And I don't think she necessarily disagrees with me. I think the question is the very one that she raises, which is what is the correct balance between our liberties and our security? And we are often told post 9/11, whether it's from Bush or Cheney or from Obama and Biden, that it's an unfortunate balance that tips in the direction of security and away from liberty. Even President Obama said it last week when he was responding to the PRISM leaks. So I'm asking the question, not just what the right balance should be, but which is more important. And I guess I come down on the side of liberty. I come down on the side of preserving what it is that is supposed to be the soul of America. And I don't want to sacrifice those liberties in order to give myself the illusion of perfect security, because there is going to always be a Boston Marathon bomber. There is going to be a terrorist attack. And terrorism, though defeated in the sense that Al-Qaeda is no longer the operating organization that could mount a multi-year operation like it did to attack the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon. I believe we've achieved that goal. That the irony for me is, okay, so then we won. So let's now continue along with adequate and effective border security and police work and even covert action. But we don't need to be doing it at the level that we did it in 2002 and 2003, and nor do we need to have the kind of footprint we have around the globe that I think itself provokes more and more terror.
Well, I, I need to ask you, because we have, as you so well documented in the book that I've been mentioning, Top Secret America, which is worth reading again now, you have this incredibly huge complex. It has grown probably even larger than this. The book is a couple of years old. The national security complex has grown by twice its pre-9/11 size, 100 acres. You've got private contractors. You've got a huge complex, billions and billions of dollars being spent. I just want to know, as taxpayers, how do we know that the system that they have set up here for going through millions and millions and millions of phone calls is an effective one? And who is making the decision as to what kind of system needs to be put in place to counter terrorism? Those seem to be, you know, fair questions.
They are fair questions, and of course they're questions that we don't seem to ever get an answer to. We sort of, the American people elected Obama twice with the promise that somehow we were going to ratchet down the intensity of the war on terrorism, and very little has changed. In fact, as the technologies have improved, we've seen a massive increase, as an example, of the use of drones.
Right.
And so I think that the question of effectiveness is an important one, but we need to understand, when we ask that question, what are we asking it about? And I want to make the point to your listeners that this is a system. It's like an industrial system. It's not like the old military-industrial complex where they produce tanks and submarines and fighter jets. This is a new industrial system, and they produce PowerPoint briefings, and they produce intelligence information. The vast majority of what companies like Booz Allen Hamilton do, the company that Snowden worked for, is providing services to the intelligence community and the security apparatus. And as an industrial system in that way, it's self-interested. This is a company that works on a profit motive. It needs to make money. What happened when Snowden's name was associated with Booz Allen Hamilton was that their stock went down 5% in one day. That makes people notice something. And so this, I liken what happened here last week more to an industrial accident than I do to some kind of threat to our national security. And the only question is it a Bhopal or Chernobyl, or is it going to be innocuous and unimportant? And I don't think we know the answer yet.
Greg in Wisconsin, hi.
Yes, I have to pull over. I was on my way to work. I was seeing red. I can't disagree more. I think that Mr. Snowden had an ulterior motive. If you're going to be a whistleblower, then come out in the open. Say what you have to say. You don't go to Hong Kong and hide for 3 weeks and then come out. You don't have a cozy connection with China and then come out. I think that this individual has an ulterior motive, as the WikiLeaks guy had an ulterior motive, in my opinion. And I think that is what this is all about. This guy is no more of a patriot than the underwear bomber. This guy had his own personal agenda, and he tried to play it out through the media. And that's what this is about. Also, we don't live in a utopia anymore, if we ever did. 9/11 occurred, but things are still going on. We can't just say, well, 9/11's over. This is 2002, 2003. We've taken care of the terrorists. This is an ongoing thing. We have to continue to be vigilant. And the prosecution and the finding of these guys, we can't just say that, you know, this has occurred a while back. We can let our foot off the gas pedal now, you know, apply the brakes a little bit. This is an ongoing thing. They're not going to stop.
Thank you very much, Greg, for your call. William.
Well, I think you can take your foot off the gas pedal. I mean, that's the reality. And let's talk about driving for a moment here, okay? we all break the law when we drive. And that's the conundrum of sort of modern world is, you know, we don't, nobody goes 55 miles an hour down the highway. So we're all breaking the law. But the guy that goes 120, he gets pulled over. And so we can take our foot off the gas pedal. I'm afraid your caller is wrong. But the world has changed, I agree. And part of the world changing is that a lot more power has been lodged in these corporations and in this national security establishment in Washington. A lot less power has been allocated to the states. And in our system of federalism and in our system that is built on the Constitution, that's not the way it's supposed to be. So a very small elite in Washington, inside the national security community, inside the compartmented parts of the national security community, makes very large decisions about the future of our nation, about the future of our economy, and has their foot on the gas pedal, and there's no state trooper out there that really effectively is overseeing what they're doing. I can't imagine that any American doesn't want to have effective oversight and effective work being done by our government, particularly by our national security community. But we no longer live in a world in which we can just accept that what they're doing is in fact the right thing or the best thing for our nation.
What about Greg's point that Snowden had ulterior political motives, that he went to China or Hong Kong of all places, part of China, and then subsequently this week has said that we've been hacking into China's documents as well?
Well, in my own long history of dealing with whistleblowers, I'm not a fan. I find them mostly to be self-interested. I find them mostly to be crazy. Snowden doesn't fit into any other category than that. I think he's politically motivated. I don't care. I don't even think he's the story. I think he should be arrested and he should be in jail because he broke the law. And he certainly violated agreements that he signed with the government when the government granted him access to top-secret compartmented information. And he will eventually be indicted, and he will eventually go to jail. Some people will see him as a hero, big deal. I don't see him as a hero. I'm just talking about the implications of the information which he released and revealed. And I'm asking the question, and I think it's a legitimate one even for somebody who supports the government, to know, what does it mean? What was so important about these documents that has disrupted the workings of Washington for a few days and has led to this radio interview? What does it mean? And we can all ask that question, whether we support the national security apparatus or not. I just happen to be very knowledgeable about the dysfunctions in this apparatus, and I think that this is just an example for me that hopefully makes most Americans realize how much we are in need of reform.
Thank you, Greg, for the call. Diane in Milwaukee, hi.
Good morning. I am less concerned about the information being collected than I am it being collected by a multinational company, corporation, for profit, and whose allegiance we don't know. I understand they're owned by the Carlyle Group, which is an arms dealer. We don't know who they're giving the information to after they take it from us. I would rather that these be government employees collecting this information. I have more confidence in their allegiance.
Why don't you talk more about the private contractors involved in this, William, how they came to be, and do you share Diane's concerns?
The growth of private contracting as an adjunct of the American government's efforts in intelligence really ballooned after 9/11. The problem that the government faced was where they had to ramp up very quickly to fight against Al-Qaeda and to fight in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And it was easier, and some would argue even more economical, for them to hire private contractors to do much of the work than it was to expand the military and the intelligence community itself internally. And in fact, the irony is that most likely, had they instituted a draft in 2001 and ingested hundreds of thousands of young men and women to fight in this war on terrorism, we'd be having a discussion right now on this radio show about the draft. So either way, the growth of private contractors was seen as necessary at the time and also was seen as a palatable alternative to the drafting of the American public involuntarily to fight in the war. What's happened is that the biggest corporations who work in the defense world have shifted much of their efforts from hardware to software, so that today companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing and General Dynamics, that Northrop Grumman, that you associate with building submarines and tanks and fighter planes, actually do a large bulk of their work in software, not in hardware, in providing these very services and capabilities to the government. So that's kind of how it's happened, how it unfolded, and it's a system that now is in place, and one of the elements of the fact that these are corporations is that they're not going to wake up tomorrow and say, "We're done. We don't need to be doing this anymore. Right. Don't give us this contract next year for $3 billion to do this work. You know, we don't need it." And so we can't have those companies, we can't rely upon those companies to ever do anything other than to be part of a machine, because that's their motive. I'm sure that the people who work for those companies are patriotic and believe in our security, but the company is about making money, mm-hmm. making money for its shareholders. And so we need to say, okay, well, how much do we need? How much defense do we need? How much effort do we need? And when Secretary of Defense Robert Gates attempted in the very late part of the Bush administration and early part of the Obama administration to pare back contractors and to reverse this trend towards greater and greater reliance on contractors, everybody applauded his efforts, and then the lobbying and the counterattack began, and now we see 5 years later that most of the Gates initiatives have been reversed and the contractors are still hiring and still vibrant profit makers in an economy that is otherwise still in trouble.
Mm-hmm. A military-industrial complex version, 2013. We continue taking phone calls. William Arkin is our guest this hour. You perhaps have seen him on national news this week or BBC, if you watch BBC. He is, he does all kinds of things. He has been an analyst and author working on the subject of national security, and it's not just what's going on now. He's been looking at this issue for some 35 years. You heard him say, and we'll have him back in September when his book American Coup is published, which looks extensively at all that we're talking about this hour. He's also co-author of Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Use our Facebook page as well. We'd like to read some of those messages on the air if you would like to send them to us that way. And you can also send us a tweet at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, the National Journal and the Atlantic teamed up for a look at how Americans are adapting to changing economic realities. They focused on Milwaukee, actually, for the first part of this series. So we'll be talking with the woman who came to Milwaukee and spoke with people in city government and universities and neighborhood improvement groups. She will be with us to discuss what she found here. And Mayor Tom Barrett will also be with us to talk about perhaps a new identification for Milwaukee as the freshwater capital of the country. Rinaldo in Rice Lake, our next caller. Hi, Rinaldo.
Hi. I agree with your guest. This is an overreach by the government. It didn't stop Benghazi. And what bothers me is when these government officials, such as the IRS, the Justice Department, do this, they're not held accountable. So what's to say that they're not going to be held accountable in this situation? And I get a kick out of this because ever since she's been president, we've had a surge in Afghanistan. We've had five terrorist attacks. Two of them didn't work because the terrorists screwed it up. So I'd like to know what exactly we're getting from spying or getting a search warrant to spy on the entire United States. On top of that, the people that are calling in our country are not getting spied on. So that search warrant goes to the rest of the world also. And I don't agree with this drone attack also. I don't believe any government official that's elected, based on the credentials that he has the power to do this without any type of trial or any type of justice.
William.
Well, the caller is hit the nail on the head. We're a country based upon a constitution and based upon a set of laws, and if we don't live by them, then we don't present the example to the rest of the world, and nor do we have the moral standing in order to convince others not to resort to terrorism. So I think that the issues are very clear for Americans. This is overreach. And whether you live in Wisconsin and believe that the issue is surveillance and loss of privacy, or you live in Washington, D.C., or anywhere else, the same questions need to be asked, which is, what is the real threat to America and what is the appropriate response to it? But I think there's also a deeper question, and that deeper question is, why is there so much distrust and hatred for Washington, and why has our country become so polarized? And I believe that to some degree, is the product of this 14-year-long war.
Steve emailed, the guest has said that the national security system is in need of reform. What reforms does he propose?
Well, I think the easiest one and the one that I think is going to be most effective is take away the goddamn money. I mean, if we're not willing to starve the system, then we're not going to see the system reform. That will at least immediately force them to focus on what's important and to eliminate what's less important. I want to have an effective counterterrorism apparatus, and I want to have an effective national security. But I think what we find with things like this is just a bit of greediness on the part of the government and on the part of the information collectors when they're not really constrained budgetarily or technologically, then they don't really have any way to measure either what they're doing or what their success is. So that's number one. Number two, I think we need to ask ourselves whether or not we can continue to check out of the question of national security. Is it men's work with a big yellow tape around it that we need to stay out of and keep out of? Or is it something that we need to get ourselves involved in more on a day-to-day basis? And Snowden, I think, probably tells us that we need to get ourselves involved, that we can't just leave it to the professionals to police themselves.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of Snowden's comments that he had as a techie, as you described him, which is apt, working for a private company, the ability to wiretap virtually anybody? He even said he could wiretap the president.
Well, I don't know what the facts are associated with what his actual capabilities were sitting in his bunker in Hawaii. But I do know that the network is the network. And somebody asked me, I think the day after Snowden's story came out, you know, how was he able to do this from Hawaii? And my answer was, hey, go on the internet right now and go read the local paper in
right.
Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the world is a network. It's networked, and there's a secret network and there's an open network, and the government wants to be able to conquer all.
Mm-hmm.
And so to some degree, I'm sure that he's just exaggerating or trying to keep himself in the news or make himself look more like a hero. But there's some truth to what he says, in the sense that once you're inside someone's network, once you are listening, watching keystrokes, listening in on conversations, surveilling from the air, you do have the ability to go virtually anywhere, and that is the world that we live in.
Yeah. Nasser in California, hi.
Good morning. Excellent topic, excellent guest. Just a few comments. You know, this guy in Hong Kong is just a bump in the world, in the secret world that your guest is talking about. And, you know, I don't want to go into the whole need to keep the war machine going and the industrial military complex. There are very few people in this country who are aware of what's going on. Maybe the percentage is higher in people who listen to public radio and your show. But, you know, in general, people in this country, which I'm part of, and my children have been born and raised here, don't really have that view of our country. We think we are a peace-loving, democratic country, and we're far from that. And, you know, I don't know what the solution is, because I enjoy the benefits of the world that I live in, and it's part of that industrial military complex. And starving it and killing it, you know, might impact our standard of living. But there's only one thing I can suggest that would help us as a nation, and it is to really understand what we are doing, and that is to be more open, more clear about our secret government, our complex, our war, our need to fight, and after we do that and everybody is aware of it, our kids, when they leave this country and visit other countries, maybe they won't be hated as much, or at least they will have some notion of why it is that the rest of the world hates them.
Thank you, Nasser, for the call. Well, transparency and openness is part, we're not getting much of it. It's hard to ask people to be open when the whole thing is based on secrecy. I don't know how you get us. I don't know how you get the story out here. Even you know how to do it, I guess. But even you must find roadblocks, William.
I do. I think your caller is wise, and I would just pick one point with him, which is that our country is based upon democracy, and if we give over the running of our country to the national security establishment, who has its goals and its interests, they're one part of our country, but now that's a part that's come to dominate everything else, so that national security needs trump human needs and trump other needs. And so I think our country is still whole. I think our country is still the beacon. But I'm not sure that within our country that there is a balance between what are our national security needs and what are our other needs.
Mm-hmm. William, thank you so much for being with us. September is when American Coup is going to be released.
That's correct, September 10th, and I look forward to being on your show again.
Well, thank you. Thank you for accepting the invitation. We'll talk to you later. Yeah. Thank you, William. William Arkin, our guest this hour. We also want to direct your attention to a book that, or to the interview we did with a co-author. William was the co-author of Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State. It was released in 2011, based on a series done in the Washington Post that's worth reading. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this program, and thanks for all of your calls. News is coming up. We'll return.